¿Qué tiene?
Oh.
And we will start at the top of the hour. Okay, we got about 2 minutes left. Trying to unmute you, there you go.
Hey there.
I was trying
Hello,
to unmute you.
Everybody.
Yep, and just so everybody knows, we're going to keep everybody on mute. Unless I'm granting them the floor, either Tina or I will do that. And in 2 minutes, we'll get started. Okay, one more minute. Okay.
Alan,
yep.
There is a question from Juliet, and she wants to know, how does one get the floor?
Sure. So basically, the way that's going to work is, and welcome everybody. Just so everybody knows, this meeting is being recorded, and we'll go ahead and kick it off. You can see the agenda here, and we will offer the option at some point during the presentation when we open the floor up for questions. If everybody can see the participants button in the bottom of the screen, at the bottom of that, there's an option to raise your hand. And then when we do have the option to have questions, you can raise your hand there and we will unmute the folks whose hands are raised in the order of which their hands are raised, given time constraints, okay? All right. Well, welcome everybody to our second virtual Civic Federation meeting. I'm going to go ahead and get started. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to have the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay. So everybody is ready. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
And to the Republic,
which stands,
one nation
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice
for all.
Thank you. Okay, let's get back to our agenda. Okay, so the first item on our agenda are the approval of our minutes. We have the minutes from our April meeting, the membership meeting, as well as the minutes from a previous meeting that we neglected to address during the last meeting. Both of those were referenced in the newsletter. So typically we do a vote, and as you may recall from our last meeting, we used offline email voting so that we could ensure that it was only delegates or designated alternates who had a vote, as we always do during regular meetings. And so we're gonna do that again today. Basically what's gonna happen is there will be an email going out. Dennis is going to send an email out to all the delegates with two questions in it to approve or reject or abstain from approving each of the two sets of minutes. We won't have those results in real time, obviously, but so that's gonna go, that'll be our official vote of record. But I also want to try, just as an experiment, just to see how this works. As some of you may know, Zoom added a bunch of new features this past weekend, and one of them is the ability to do polling inside of a meeting. So the minutes are gonna go out again. The official vote is gonna happen via email. So delegates, check your email and vote to approve them or not, as the case may be, when you get that email. But for right now, if everybody could go to the participants button on the bottom of the screen, you'll see a button that says participants. At the bottom of it, you'll see some buttons inside of there. You'll see yes, no, go slower, go faster, etc. So if everybody who would like to approve the minutes can just click the yes button. And if anybody doesn't want to approve them, don't click anything, or click no if you want to, you know, not approve them. So we want to check this out just to see how it works. Now this is anonymous. It's not showing me who is answering what. There are other mechanisms that we are exploring to try and have a live vote in the middle of a meeting, but for now, this is just a test, just to see. And again, the official recorded vote is going to go out via email. Okay. All right, so I'm just going to leave that open for now. Vote as you care to. So back to our agenda. So tonight we have a very exciting program. We have our distinguished Commonwealth attorney, Parisa Dehghani Tafti, and she's going to be presenting on changes in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, first quarter progress. We'll have her presentation, then we'll have about 10 minutes or so for questions. The Legislative Affairs and Public Services Committee have provided some questions for her to evaluate, and then I'm going to read those, and if there's still time, we will open the floor up for questions from the floor, and we'll use the mechanism that was described a little bit earlier, where in that same participants window, you have the option to raise your hand, and I will look at the raised hands and determine in order who asks questions, and please bear in mind, asking questions is currently restricted to actual delegates or designated alternates. So we will do that when we get to that point. Later on in the program, we have Bill Browning, who is here presenting on white-tailed deer and forest health. And we will also have a presentation and a resolution from the Parks and Rec Committee, which will be led by Duke Banks and a couple of other folks, which should be rather exciting. So, with that said, Parisa, are you here? I'm gonna stop sharing here, and then I'm gonna pull up, there you are. I'm gonna unmute you. Hello.
Hi.
I'm gonna pull up your presentation, and then, let's see, first quarter update CivFed, is that the one? Let me actually go into screen presentation mode first. There we go. Okay, bear with me for 1 second. Oops, sorry. All right, sorry about that. Share screen. There we go, slideshow. Okay. Can everybody see that? Yep. Okay. So, Parisa, if you just prompt me, just say something and I'll advance the slides for you, and you're welcome to go ahead.
Thanks. I'll do my best to remember to prompt. since this is my first time, or my second time only, doing Zoom and PowerPoint at the same time. So everybody, thank you. Thank you for having me. I am delighted to be here. You can go ahead and go to the first slide. I'd like to talk a little bit about the goals that I had coming into office. And I just wanted to note at the outset that my coming into this role was the first time in anyone's living memory that someone from outside the office was taking leadership within the office. And so it was new to everybody. It's new to me, it's new to the folks in the office, it's new to all of the stakeholders, and it's new to the entire community. So as such, you know, I thought it was important to establish and maintain trust and professionalism in the office. I thought it was important to establish trust and rapport with stakeholders, and then to begin fulfilling the campaign promises. And I was lucky that I had the blessing of time. While I didn't take the general for granted, I did spend the time from between the primary and December actually working on the transition. And so I started out with sending out questionnaires to folks in the office, met with every single member of the staff one-on-one, and made sure that we brought in folks who had the sort of the right fit and the philosophy, along with the folks who were staying on, so that we had a nice mixture of maintaining talent and institutional knowledge, as well as like-minded attorneys. And so that was sort of internally. Externally, I don't think it's any surprise to anybody that there were some relationships that needed building. I was lucky that I had a good relationship already with DHS and with the Sheriff's Department and with organizations like OAR, but there was definitely work that needed to be done with the court and with police. And I began doing that immediately. My first call was to the ACPD Police Chief, Jay Farr, and we started meeting with leadership, and I got involved with a large forum that all of the officers were invited to, each one. And we had some frank conversations and sometimes disagreements, and but we did start the process of, you know, building lines of communication. And I continue to meet with the police regularly. And obviously, you know, every time there's a question in a case or anything like that, there are open lines of communication now. And, you know, I wanted to start to fulfill the campaign promises. I approached that carefully. I didn't want to just come in and break things that weren't broken. And so, like I said, I spent some time figuring out what the guiding principles would be, along with my transition team and the folks that stayed on in the office. And there's an awful lot I couldn't have anticipated, COVID being the most obvious, but from the beginning to the end, I wanted to make sure that we created a process that was seamless, that people had buy-in into, that was inclusive and collaborative, and that there was as much collaboration as there could be, given that somebody new was coming into the office. I think you can advance to the next slide now. The four core functions. Let's go back. Okay. So I talked a lot for over a year about how I saw the four core functions of the office. And those are, you know, priorities and policies, community engagement, advocacy, and management. And I talked a little bit about management in the way that I brought folks into the office. But if you advance to the next slide, I'll start talking about policies and priorities in a little bit more detail. Some of those policies were, and what we've done already, is stop asking for cash bail, because I had always said that I thought that cash bail was ineffective, unfair, and not particularly useful in accomplishing the goals that it set out to achieve, and at least not any more useful than other tools that we had in our toolbox. And so while we have stopped asking for cash bail, and our position in court has been, if somebody is dangerous or a flight risk and we can't mitigate those risks, then they should be held. And if we can mitigate those risks, then we should be doing it through supervision, through support systems, through electronic monitoring, and through other means, and not through cash bail. And while judges sometimes impose cash bail over our objection, we continue to abide by those principles. My perspective is nobody should remain incarcerated simply because they can't afford to pay their way out of jail. And we know from study after study that supervision and support services are actually as effective, if not more effective, in getting people back to court and preventing recidivism as cash bail is. Our office stopped prosecuting simple marijuana possession charges in circumstances where it was not a public safety concern. So if it didn't involve using around children, if it didn't involve distribution, if it didn't involve driving while impaired, particularly knowing that the law was about to change and being involved in the process of advocating for changes, we were not prosecuting it where we didn't think that it was a public safety concern. And finally, one of the main things that we've done right away is we have implemented changes to make discovery fair and fast, and while maintaining our obligation and the desire, obviously, to protect victims, survivors, and witnesses. So we no longer require defense attorneys to be present at the office to take notes on file. Instead, we provide electronic discovery whenever possible. And we do have some technological challenges that we are trying to address, and the county has been great in working with us to address that, some of those. But where we can't actually, because of the state of our systems right now, provide things like video, we are doing our best to provide them as early as possible and allow defense attorneys to simply copy them instead of having to watch them in the office. We are working also with our system partners like Doorways, CAC, in fact, to ensure that privacy of victims and safety of victims, particularly domestic violence and sexual assault victims, while honoring our due process and ethical obligations. We are implementing a new model of prosecution, traditionally called vertical prosecution. And basically what it means is that one prosecutor gets a case early in the life of the case, regardless of whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. And that prosecutor or team of prosecutors works on that case throughout the life of the case. And so police know exactly who to talk to, instead of cases being handled at different stages by different attorneys. Police know exactly who to talk to. Witnesses and victims know exactly who to talk to. They develop relationships with the prosecutor. And it allows for early discovery. It allows for fair plea negotiations. It allows for accountability and ownership, and hopefully a smoother process and a much quicker process in terms of being able to work out cases. We, like I said, have a lot more work to do to make it faster and more automated, but we have gone a long way already, and we've gone a long way despite COVID. If you could advance to the next slide, please. So some of our priorities and policies have been youth diversion, restorative justice, and the behavioral health docket. We have worked with court services, which is the county's juvenile intake department, to put procedures in place that will help divert more kids out of the court system to begin with. So even before being petitioned, we've put in place processes that can help kids get treatment that they need, to help kids get services that they need, and to help kids really be able to change their path. Because the perspective being that if we can put kids on the right track and prevent them from ever entering a courtroom, that's a huge success. We worked very hard during the transition period with the Annie E. Casey Foundation to secure a national expert on restorative justice. And so she's working with the county as an executive on loan And she's helping to create a statewide restorative, a countywide, restorative justice program. And that includes schools, which some of our victim witness staff are involved in, but our office is not directly involved in other than that. The community, so that community members, when there isn't legal recourse for something, can or where they prefer for there not to be court involvement, where they can actually refer each other and refer themselves to restorative justice programs, and obviously in the criminal legal system, so that when people are court involved, there is still an opportunity for restorative justice on the theory and based on the evidence that restorative justice actually helps victims heal more quickly and more satisfactorily, but also helps reduce recidivism because it actually helps people who've done harm to transform into somebody who won't do that again. And the recidivism rates plummet, 20 percentage points when you compare traditional diversion programs and restorative justice programs, and even more than that when you compare nothing or the traditional retributive justice to restorative justice. And finally, the behavioral health docket, we have been working on it. We've been able to shape it so that it's available before pleas as well as after pleas, so that somebody doesn't necessarily have to get a conviction, a criminal record, just because they're mentally ill. And we've established a collaborative process for managing the docket and a commitment to reviewing its efficacy every so often, so that once it's launched, we can make sure that it is working, that it is working for all of the parties, that it is not excluding folks that we would want included on the docket. And while it's been on hold, we are hoping because of COVID and because we had 4-day planning sessions that had to get postponed. So it is on hold a little bit for now until we can get everybody trained up, but it is still a priority. Next slide, please. So some of the community engagement, I'm going to start a little bit backwards and start with a sexual assault response team. It was mandated by the statute in 2009, and it got up and running a few years ago with its protocols. And what the SART does is it provides an opportunity for community engagement and collaboration. It involves a diverse array of community partners like Doorways, our office, Project Peace, the Victim Witness Program, ACPD, Falls Church PD, the FACT unit, representatives from the military, Marymount, the county board, and others. And what we've decided to do is engage SART more frequently and to try to expand it in the model that Community Peace already exists in, so that we have sort of goals and projects, and that it includes everything from prevention to the first response to aftercare. And to help us do that, we are actually doing the SART data visualization project. It was started a while back, but we have some of the data, and we're talking about how to improve outcomes and how to improve data and how to, when we do actually publicize some of it, if possible, to use the data not only to educate and prevent, but also to reduce some of the shame and stigma and barriers to reporting, and to make sure that survivors feel less alone and encourage them to take advantage of the resources that are available to them in the community. And like I said, going backwards, one of the things that we haven't focused a lot on is juror participation. We've always had juries, but prosecutors have traditionally struck members of the public from juries without cause. Those are called peremptory strikes. And I wanted the office to rise to a higher standard, both for the sake of community participation in the judicial process and for transparency. So we have a commitment to not strike jurors without cause. And that's because we want to ensure that every single person who is called to jury duty has an ability to discharge their civic duties unless there's a real potential for bias. And we want to do our best to have a representative and fair cross-section of the community and not exclude community members for reasons that don't have to do with bias. And finally, with COVID, I have been working with the sheriff's office and with the public defender and the public defense bar to try to thin out the jail population as much as possible in order to protect both the people who are incarcerated, but also the sheriff's deputies who are in and out of the jail. You know, they go into the jail, they're exposed, and then they go home to their families. And we wanted to reduce the likelihood that we would end up with COVID in our jail as much as possible. And I think we've done an incredible job collaborating with each other from the police and sort of issuing summonses as much as possible rather than arresting people from our end, trying to get people more aggressively out on bond conditions, even going back and looking at jail lists to look to see who had bond set or who had bail set and couldn't make it, and trying to get folks out who wouldn't pose a risk to the community. And you know, it's been incredible collaboration with nonprofit organizations to try to provide support when people are released, from the sheriff's department and providing us constant information and working with us to identify the right people, and with the defense bar to come to an agreement on as many cases as we can. And like I said, from the front end, the police have done incredible work in reducing the number of arrests to begin with. Next slide, please. So managing the office is one of the other sort of core functions. And this really is the area that we have the most significant challenges. And we are working to correct some serious technological deficiencies. When COVID appeared on the horizon, it became really clear that we had no teleworking capabilities because of the way that our network was set up and the general lack of access that we had to our files when we were not physically in the office. We are working on that, but the problems are so basic that, I mean, it's as basic as, you know, the laptop that I'm working on right now has 128 gigabytes of memory, but we routinely work on cases that have 30 gigabytes of data. And so we have nowhere to put that, really. So, you know, we've cobbled a lot together. But what we're doing is trying to move as much as we can into the cloud. We're working with the county and trying to fix that situation so that we're more secure, so that we have our work accessible from, you know, more than just our office and more than just physical files, and so that we can obviously at the end of the day be able to provide discovery and do our work in a more efficient way. I spoke a little bit about vertical prosecution and what we're doing that. We met with the judges. We studied the process thoroughly. We met with everyone in the office to sort of gather their expertise and figure out what the best setup was and what the best rollout would be. And we've started rolling it out. And attorneys are already reporting that they're really, really happy with the ownership and accountability, and that the feeling that they have of when they do something in a case, their work is not wasted. And somebody else is not going to have to redo that work, or and that it's really sort of a feeling of strong ownership over the case and how it ends up. The leadership team is a mix of veterans and new folks. And the new folks are a mix of longtime prosecutors from other jurisdictions, as well as former defense attorneys. And you know, I've made sure that we have a leadership team that makes, you know, strong decisions, that argues with each other, and that, you know, operates on our guiding principles and really takes a new eye to the way that things are done. We've also, as part of our work, started what I call Reform University, or I call it that now, but one of my assistants really called it Reform University. And that's part of the training that we're doing. You know, we started it got cut off by COVID, but we are bringing training into the offices on issues like collateral consequences of convictions, on issues like immigration and the way that immigration intersects with the criminal legal system, and how to collect and use data and that sort of thing. And part of that is a planned prison visit, which it's unclear when we will be able to do it. But one of the core beliefs that I have is that nobody should send someone to a place that they don't, without having been there themselves. And that's particularly true of a place like jail or prison. And the assistants are really excited about going in and meeting with, and it's not sort of just a tour where you walk through. What we're planning is some in-depth meeting with both correctional officers and inmates within one of Virginia's prisons. Next slide, please. We have seen a lot of really great criminal justice reform in the last legislative session. Obviously, the credit goes to the legislators themselves, like Patrick Hope, Alfonso Lopez, Marcus Simon, Mark Levine, Rip Sullivan, Adam Eben, Barbara Favola, and others. But also equal amount of credit should go to organizations like Justice Forward, the ACLU, and the CIFED for the resolutions that you all have put together and fought for. For my part, a central part of my campaign was to engage in advocacy and to do it transparently. I wasn't going to remain on the sidelines, so I went to Richmond a number of times and met with not just the Virginia Association of Commonwealth Attorneys and tried to convince them to engage in reform and not fight reform, but also to meet with legislators myself and with a small group of like-minded reform prosecutors. And to that end, some of the things that we've worked on and succeeded at were criminal justice reform for youth. Can you go to the next slide, please? So beginning on July 1st, a child can't be tried as an adult until they're 16 years old. And I know that was one of the things that was important to the CIFED, and it was one of the things that I supported, raising the age from 14 to 16, and advocated for that. The next slide, please. In another area of reform, justice reform for youth, and I know this was also something that the CIFED had focused on, and it was in one of your resolutions, is taking disorderly conduct out of the code for students who, at school, for behavior at school and on school trips and on buses. And that doesn't mean that they can't be charged with things that are crimes, like if they assault somebody, it's an assault, but there isn't this sort of catch-all disorderly that would capture people who have, done things short of committing crimes. Next slide, please. More criminal justice reform for youth. In Virginia, we had life without parole. Advocated to help make juveniles who were sentenced to life without parole eligible for parole after serving 20 years. Now, that doesn't mean that people will get out necessarily. What it means is that they'll be eligible to be considered for release. And that's really important because for two reasons. The first is that we know that juvenile brains are just not as developed as adult brains, and that we don't have fully functional brains until we're about 22, 23 years old. And so for somebody to spend their life without any hope of release in prison for something that they did when they were 16 or 17 or 18 is contrary to science and really inhumane. But we also know that giving people hope actually helps them transform. And so I wanted to make sure that the work that we did, permitted people to learn how to have an incentive to behave differently and to learn better and to do better and to invest in themselves. And so we did achieve that. I know that the CIFED has had a resolution calling for the legalization of marijuana, And we didn't get legalization, even though I did advocate for it, but we did get to a place where marijuana possession is decriminalized. And so it's a $25 fine for less than 1 ounce of the plant material. And, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to say advance. Oil containing THC is now decriminalized. And both are legal for medical purposes. There is, the governor amended the legislation to include a study for legalization, which I found heartening, and I'm hopeful that next year we will get legalization with some thought to equity in when licenses are distributed, so that, you know, big marijuana, medicinal marijuana companies and big corporations don't scoop up the first licenses, but that we can bring in communities that have been affected. We did not get expungement yet, but all of the expungement bills have been sent to the Crime Commission, and I'm hoping that when we do get a little bit more movement on marijuana reform, that we'll also get movement on expungement in that area. Next slide, please. One of the things that's very near and dear to my heart, and I know this was not one of the CIFED priorities, but it's legislation that I had worked on before I even began running for office, and that was making it possible for people who had been convicted of crimes that they didn't commit have better access to courts when they were convicted based on things that we know now to be junk science, and also to allow people who had pled guilty to have DNA testing in their cases and to be able to seek writs of actual innocence. Because what we do know is that around the nation, 10% of the people who were exonerated by DNA evidence had actually pled guilty. And so that's a pretty high rate of people to exclude from that process. And it's subject to sort of budgetary issues at this point, but the legislation did pass. And so I'm hoping that there will be more meaningful ways of safeguarding people's rights in this process and correcting mistakes, because, you know, we are human beings and the system that we have created is a human system, and it is going to make errors, and having this kind of a safety net, I think will help a lot of people sleep better at night. Next slide, please. And finally, one of the things that I advocated for was for juries to know what the penalties are in a case before they enter into deliberations. That's in part so that people who feel like they can't impose a certain sentence can speak out about that at the beginning of a case, but also so that jurors don't end up feeling feeling like, you know, they, right now the process is bifurcated where juries decide guilt or innocence and then they go and deliberate again to recommend a sentence. And it was important to me that jurors know, even before they decide guilt or innocence, what the effects of that conviction would be and what they would be then looking at. There's still a long way to go in terms of allowing jurors to have a little more flexibility to do some of the things that I know juries have asked to do, like suspend a certain amount of time or to recommend conditions. So if we're going to have jury recommendations, I think that juries should have sort of the whole panoply of things to choose from. Otherwise, you know, the judges really should be making these decisions. And so right now we got to informed juries, but there's still a lot of room to go. And I will ask you to go to that last slide, please. And I'm happy to take questions and then close up, or close up, but.
Yeah, so what we'll do is I have some questions that a couple of committees have put together for you. I will read those, give you a little bit of time to answer, and then I have a list of folks who are raising their hands already, and we will give them the floor. We actually got started a little bit early, so we've got some time for questions. So I'll go through the ones first that were presented by the committees. Give me 1 second here to pull them up. Okay, here we go. So I believe you have answered this first question, but I'll answer it again real quickly. During your campaign for office, you promised to support legislative reforms. What work have you done in response to the criminal justice resolutions passed by the Arlington County Civic Federation? I think you addressed that pretty thoroughly as well already. So let's go.
I accidentally skip the felony larceny threshold, though, which has gone up from 500. I know that was one of the CIFED's priorities. It's gone up from 500 to 1,000 beginning July 1st.
Okay, excellent. Okay. The second question is, how are you working with the Arlington Public Schools, the Arlington County Police Department, and the Department of Human Services and nonprofit groups to coordinate responses to youth with mental health concerns before, during, and after any involvement with law enforcement and the justice system?
I think this is the youth is an area where we need to do a lot more work in terms of the youth and mental health. What I am doing is collaborating with the Department of Human Services to try to troubleshoot. And in fact, we have a meeting scheduled later this week. It was initially about specific cases and how to handle folks who are unable to or refuse services. I'm planning on bringing up the issue of youth as well. I support youth, the counselors in school, and think that we should be spending more of our resources, including counselors. And I think that the restorative justice in schools will actually, I'm hoping that it will actually help that piece as well, to sort of allow people to get more in-depth into what's going on with an individual when they do harm, and also to deal with trauma, because most of the kids that are the kids that do harm have actually been traumatized themselves. And so trying to break that cycle through restorative justice is really important to me.
Okay, great. Thank you. Next question. You have indicated that justice and safety are inseparable. What actions have you initiated to coordinate and strengthen joint approaches with the Arlington County Police Department?
So I look at that as two questions, and I'm going to answer the second part of the question first and then circle back. And I think I did a lot of the second part, but it's worth repeating. This was the first time in anybody's living memory that somebody from outside of the office was going to come in and that this entire system was going to feel a tremendous shock. I put in a call to the chief immediately after the primary. We met multiple times during the summer with him and with his leadership team. I've also had a great relationship with Falls Church police before that. I participated in addition to sort of leadership meetings, I participated in these three large fora where there were over an hour each. There were over 50 officers at each one, and they were hard. And I definitely took some punches, but we did open up lines of communications, and we do have regular meetings. And I have kept a promise that I made to all of my chiefs, both Airport Authority and Metro and ACPD and Falls Church, is that I would give them a notice of any changes in policy or any particular cases that we're handling that would impact their officers, so that they wouldn't have to learn about anything that my office was doing that was going to impact them through word of mouth or worse through the press. And so I've kept that promise. At the end of the day, the police and my office have the same goal, and that's to protect and serve the community. And we have been working together towards that goal. But I think that the safety and justice piece of that is actually a separate question. I know I've indicated that in the past that the traditional approach towards safety and justice has actually set them up as opposing values, and that with the idea that in order to be safe, we have to sacrifice some justice and we have to sacrifice some fairness, and that we have to live with things like mandatory minimums or high incarceration rates, and that we have to accept or ignore racial disparities in our system. And I just take a different view to that. And I think that the approach that I take sees safety and justice as intertwined, and that we have to have procedural justice, we have to have fairness, we have to have equity in order to have safety in the long term. And the COVID situation, I think, shows us that sort of putting justice and safety against each other is really creating a false choice for us. Because if we can work together to reduce the number of people that are going to jail, and the number of people that are in jail, and the number of people that are in prisons, in order to enable social distancing at the facilities, in order to protect correctional officers and their families and the community at large, and we know that 95% of the people that are incarcerated are eventually going to be released back into our community, then what we really need to be asking ourselves is, why for so long have we adhered to a purely retributive notion of what justice is? And so that's the, you know, I view them as, you know, that they're smushed into the same question, but really I think that they're different issues.
Understood. Okay, well, there are several people who have their hands raised to ask questions, so I'm going to go ahead and unmute them one at a time to ask questions. And questioners, those of you who have raised your hands in the participants window, we'll try and get to all of you. We've only got a little more than 10 minutes left for this section, so what I'll do is you'll have 30 seconds to answer your question, ask your question, and then I'll turn it over to the Commonwealth Attorney. The first person up is Maliva Hartman. Go ahead, Ms. Hartman.
Yes, and thank you for being here and speaking to us. Very enlightening. You have a progressive agenda, and I'm sure, and I know it has challenges. My question is multi-part. Do you have full staffing at this time, / adequate resources? And with the coming budget, which we know is going to affect everyone, how is this going to impact your office?
We are not quite yet at a full staffing. We have two IT positions to fill and two attorney positions to fill. But we are getting there. We have fantastic candidates, and we are trying to get them in sooner rather than later. Do I have adequate resources? I don't think so. That's a really complex question, because Virginia, notoriously, and every single Commonwealth attorney will say this, no matter where they are on the political spectrum, Virginia has really done criminal justice on the cheap. And if you look at, Ithaca, New York, for example, is a similarly sized jurisdiction to Arlington, but rather than have 16 attorneys, they have somewhere upwards of 130 attorneys. The same is true all over the Commonwealth. When you look at the sort of the size of the jurisdictions compared to the size of jurisdictions in other places, we are very, very, very much under-resourced. So no, we don't have enough resources. The county has been fantastic in working with me so far, and I'm hoping that we don't take too much of a hit. I can't see into the future, but I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that you don't lose any resources. And then I'm already beating the bushes for grants everywhere that I can.
Thank you. Next question is from Richard. Richard, if you would, I'm trying to unmute you. I think you're unmuted. If you could identify the name of your civic association or your organization.
Yeah, Arlington Forest Civic Association.
Okay, go ahead, please.
You stated, Parissa, that you're not prosecuting, I guess, simple marijuana possession. Are there other types of crimes that you are electing not to prosecute at this point?
Well, even the simple marijuana possession is on a case-by-case basis. You know, as I said, we're looking at every single case to make sure that it is not a public safety concern. And so, you know, while the broader principle is to to deprioritize those cases. There's no blanket rule. It's everything we've done has been on a case-by-case basis, and we have convicted people for marijuana possession where it was a safety concern. And so to that effect, there are certainly priorities that we have, and the priorities are to focus on serious cases, to focus on violent cases, and to focus on cases where there are victims.
Thank you. The next question is from Joe Pelton.
Oh, am I unmuted?
You're fine. Yes. Thank you.
During your campaign, you actually noted that we were rather harsh in our prosecution of nonviolent crimes and compared Arlington to other jurisdictions. Can you give us an update of where Arlington stands? Is it like the most aggressive in the state still, or has it changed? I also would like to know whether there's any top priority still outstanding that you would like to address.
We are working on trying to take a more even-handed and restorative and rehabilitative approach to nonviolent cases. It's been a little bit harder since COVID because the partners that we rely on also have reduced their services somewhat. And so there's a lot of work to still be done. We barely got 2 months in before COVID sort of turned everything upside down, but we are working on it. And, one of the sort of next areas that I want to address is, probation violations, particularly for things that are considered technical violations, which are things like, not showing up or testing positive, that are not necessarily in and of themselves new crimes, but end up in significant prison sentences because of somebody sort of got off track.
Thank you. The next question is from Scott Miles from Aurora Highlands.
Thank you. Parisa, so in Aurora Highlands or in Pentagon City and Crystal City, we've experienced what feels like a spike in more dangerous armed crimes and carjackings. And I know the police are actively working on these, but our perception is that perpetrators are from DC or Maryland or at least flee there because it's really seconds away. So I'm interested to know, to the best of your knowledge, if any of the changes you've implemented you feel have an effect on the rate we're seeing, and then are you able to work cross jurisdictionally to be able to solve and prosecute those crimes?
So I'm trying to work on ways to work cross jurisdictionally. It's particularly challenging when you're talking about youth. We have a number of kids locked up in our landmark facility who are from DC, and because we have no jurisdiction when they go back to DC, we're sort of left in between a rock and a hard place. Like, we still have jurisdiction over what they did, but it's hard to monitor them. We don't have the ways of providing support for them and supervision in the way that we do for kids who are from Arlington. Not prosecuting marijuana is not the thing that causes an armed carjacking, so it's like, I take serious things seriously. And so the uptick, the perceived uptick in that is not, can't be connected to the policies, of handling nonviolent, crimes in a different way. But these tend to be sort of the same groups of people. And so when the police, break up those groups, then, the crimes tend to fall away and it ebbs and flows. It's, there've been spikes in previous years as well. That group gets broken up and then, a couple of years later, something else comes up. And I know that the police are doing a really great job. We've gotten some of those folks and we're taking those cases in the office really seriously. And I don't plan on being careless with cases where people's lives are at stake.
Thank you. Next question is from Bernie Byrne. Go ahead, Mr. Byrne.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Have Now, you have a program established yet to track to see how many of these people who are getting to get out of jail free or going to the card are going to be committing second crimes, or if they didn't even go to jail in the first place, if they are then going to commit a crime, and comparing them with the existing change? Because this liberalization, I think a lot of people opposed to it, because you know there's an idea when you do the time, if you commit the crime, you should do the time. We won't see this. We want to see, is your thing having any beneficial effect at all in the community, or is it getting worse?
Thank you, Mr. Byrne.
Well, I mean, the data is, you know, barely a few months old in Arlington. We do know that incarceration rates, even in Arlington, have been going down, and were going down even last year. What we see in other neighborhoods and sort of in meta studies is that there is no increase in crime that's correlated with decarceral policies. And nobody's getting a get out of jail free card. Even restorative justice is not a get out of jail free card. We're looking to treat illness like illness. We're looking to treat kids like kids. And we're looking for active accountability as opposed to passive accountability. And so being locked in a cage is it incapacitates people, but it's a very passive accountability that ultimately, the longer they are in jail, the harder it is to reintegrate and to get on the right track when you're out. And there is no debating that over 95% of the people who are in jails and prisons will eventually return to the community. Very, very small percentages actually will stay locked up for the rest of their lives. So our challenge is how do we get people back into the community after what is a reasonable and appropriate amount of time? And what supports do we give them to ensure that they have the best chance of not recidivating? And you know, I'm not going to lie to you that there's going to be, you know, social problems and crime. When you look at a country that is about to is looking at a 30% unemployment rate, that's going to be a serious source of crime. When you look at people who've lost family members to disease and now, you know, are lacking support system, that is what's going to increase crime. So, you know, I'm anticipating that there will be increases, but those aren't going to have anything, those are not going to be directly related to decarceral policies or reform policies, because, you know, even Ken Cuccinelli believes in reducing the prison population and treatment over incarceration. It crosses wide ideological perspectives. But, you know, what we really need to do is create opportunities and safety nets for people if we want to have to enjoy a crime-free society.
We have time for two more questions. Parisa has to be somewhere else at the top of the hour. So the next question is from Chris Ho.
Great. First, thank you very much for spending time speaking with us this evening and for all you're trying to do. I just wanted to ask, in terms of your own measurement, how do you plan to set your standards for success and hold yourself accountable to the voters to show what you've done and what still more remains to be done on your agenda?
I mean, part of it is putting programs in place. I'm trying to get away from the sort of counting or using at convictions as a measuring stick. So, you know, when we're looking at the cash bail, I mean, it's complicated and there's a lot of different factors that go into it. But when we look at the cash bail, right, one of the factors is, you know, are people committing more crimes while they're out on cash bail as opposed to on supervision? You also need to then look at, are people showing up at the same rates on cash bail versus on supervision? And the other thing that I look at is, and those are going to take sort of long time studies. Like that data is not going to be in a week or two. But what is in is looking at, you know, the jail population and saying, you know, are we incarcerating people who don't actually pose a risk? Are we incarcerating more people now to try to make sure that we don't end up inserting new and different kinds of biases and sort of, you know, letting the cash bail policy backfire into more people being incarcerated who shouldn't be incarcerated? So it's complicated, and I'm working with data people to figure out ways to track as much as we can and to be as transparent as we can. But that's going to take sort of updating our case management system significantly, making tweaks to our case management system so that we're tracking things better, and getting people who actually know how to run data and analyze data, which most lawyers don't know how to do.
Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah.
Okay. This question is from Nicole Merlin. Go ahead, Nicole.
Hey, Priyasa, thank you for coming. I'm with Normal, so on their behalf, thank you for your work on reducing possession prosecutions, and I'm excited to hear about your looking into the probation violations. My question is actually about renters. Obviously, right now we're in a pandemic. 60% of Arlington households are rented. We will soon see an end to the stopping of evictions, and you'll have probably some folks coming up for eviction proceedings once that's lifted. Is that in your docket, the circuit docket? And is there any way to also look into creating a docket similarly to what you're doing with the mental health cases for renters?
It is not a part of my docket or my purview or jurisdiction. To the extent that I deal with eviction, it's really sort of looking at the collateral consequences of a conviction and whether or not that causes somebody to end up losing their home. But I do think that that's a good idea. I think talking to the Arlington Bar Association would be great for that. I mean, we've already seen, you know, talking to DHS, we've already seen an increase in homelessness in Arlington. And they're homeless folks that are not already known to DHS. So they have a pretty good handle because they actually go and reach out in Arlington to find folks who are homeless. They're finding a whole new population of homeless individuals that were not previously known to them. And so we are in a difficult position. And if there's things that can be done to try to help that, I think that would be great. I also think that, you know, particularly small scale landlords, you know, also need a certain measure of protection as well. Like if you have, you know, there's a distinction to be made, I think, with sort of like a big corporation that, or a big management company that owns units and sort of a smaller business type landlord as well. So I think we need to do a lot to protect, you know, families that are renting out one or two units, and also to help folks who are renting so that we make sure that we don't end up with a huge exploding homeless population in Arlington or flight from Arlington, which would reduce sort of the fabric of our community in significant and undesirable ways.
Okay, great. All right. Well, that is all the time we have for your presentation. We really appreciate you coming out.
Thank you.
We would have a round of applause, but that with over Zoom tends to get rather difficult. So again, thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate everything you had to say and your work. And I will tell you personally, my teenage daughter who's about to graduate from WNL is a huge fan. She's always quoting you about half the things you said tonight. So,
well, thank you. If she's looking for an internship, you know, I'll send a resume.
Bear that in mind.
And congratulations to her.
Thank you so much.
Have a good night.
Take care. Okay. All right. So, next up on the agenda is now we're really going to get very serious. And we have a presentation from Bill Browning on white-tailed deer and forest health in Northern Virginia. Bill,
I believe you're here somewhere. If you could wave your hand so I can see you, so I can unmute you. Let's see. Participants. All right, there you are. Okay. Bill?
Yes.
You have the floor, and then I'm going to go ahead and pull up your presentation as well.
Thank you, and thanks for having me here tonight. It's going to be quite a transition going from restorative justice to DEAR, but I'll see what I can do to keep everybody entertained. I'm with the Arlington Regional Master Naturalists. We are a group here in the, I'm not seeing the presentation. There we go. Mm-hmm. Back one slide, please. That's two slides in. And I'm here with two of my colleagues, Colt Gregory and Marion Jordan. They're also online with us to help me answer questions if I need some help. We are here in an educational role. We want to help people understand what is going on with DEAR in the art area. And we've been watching this issue for quite a while. We've been working on this presentation for over a year. We started giving it to civic associations last fall. We've given it about 20 different times to several civic associations, book clubs, garden clubs, county board members, Parks and Recs Department, et cetera. We've given a presentation to about 300 people. If anybody in the audience is intrigued with this talk and wants to hear more from us, please contact us afterwards and we'll be happy to arrange a presentation for your group. Next slide, please. The presentation is about deer. There they are. They're beautiful, they're graceful. Lots of people think deer are cute. They can run fast, they can jump high, they can jump far. They're huge. Adult male deer can weigh up to 400 pounds. They are our largest herbivore in Virginia. Next slide, please. We got too many of them. On the left is a photo from the Dover Crystal neighborhood, just about a block off Nellie Custis Road. And there's about six or eight deer sitting there on the neighbor's steps eating the flocks there. There were about 400,000 to 800,000 deer when the Western European settlers came to Virginia. That graph on the right-hand side comes from the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries in Virginia. They're in charge of watching over the deer population. Through development, hunting, growth in the population in Virginia, we nearly got rid of all of the deer in Virginia. Around about 1930, the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries started importing deer from neighboring states in the Midwest to get our population back so the hunters would have something to do. They were part of the fuel for our society. The term buck for a dollar comes from the buckskins. In the settlers' days, people used deer skins for money. Currently, we're up to about 1 million deer in the state. Their does can have fawns for up to 10 years. They can have 2 to 3 fawns per year. Herds can double in size every year. Next slide, please. Not only do we have a lot of deer, next slide, please. There we go. Not only do we have a lot of deer, nope, back one. Back one slide, there we go. One forward, please. There, stay. Feel like I'm speaking to my dog, Alan. Stay. On the left, there are two photos, one from my yard, one from a fellow Armin member's yard. We're holding on the ground by the wheelbarrow, and what Todd is holding there in the middle is about 10 pounds of vegetation. Now that's English ivy. It tends to be pretty heavy compared to what deer prefer to eat. The deer eat about 5 to 7 pounds of vegetation per day. So expand those bundles that we're holding and you can imagine how much vegetation deer eat. The mulch piles on the right are approximately what a ton of mulch weighs about. And that's about what a deer can eat in a whole year. Mulch, as you can imagine, is way heavier than a leaf, which is what the deer actually eat. Arlington has about 800 acres of land where deer can live and eat, feed themselves. A square mile is about 640 acres. So Arlington has a slightly more than a square mile of forest for the deer. Biologists, wildlife biologists, estimate that a healthy forest can generate enough vegetation to support about 15 to 20 deer. So that means Arlington can support about 20, maybe 30 deer. Next slide, please. On the left, I want to take a moment for take a look at the forest on the left. That's a healthy forest with a healthy understory. It provides essential ecosystem services. There's a buffer in there for absorbing storm water when it rains. That forest can absorb the rain and mitigate any flooding that might happen. It absorbs oils and chemicals and sediments before they flow into the Chesapeake Bay, preventing the destruction of the oyster breeding grounds. This healthy forest on the left-hand side provides a habitat, a vertical habitat, vertical range of habitat rather, for wildlife, insects, small mammals, reptiles, anything that dies and lives in that range of the forest has a place to live over there. On the right-hand side, that understory is missing. The right-hand side forest, the picture of the forest on the right-hand side is of one that's been heavily browsed by deer. If you look through that forest from about eye level down to the ground, there's nothing there. It can't absorb water. It can't absorb rain. A baby oak seedling pokes its head up out of the ground. The deer are quick to eat it. The understory is never allowed to develop. And when older trees die, there's no selection of mid-sized trees to take over. We're looking at a forest that is unable to regenerate itself. If anybody knows Rod Simmons, he's a former Arlington resident. He was now works in Alexandria City. He commented, at some point, the plants just give up. Next slide, please. Here's a quick example of a bird that can't live in that forest on the right-hand side. Our forest does not have the habitat to support the wood thrush. It forages on the ground, which exposes it to predators. It builds its nest at about height where the vegetation stops. And the recent data on bird loss in our country is astonishing. The estimate is about 50% of our songbirds over the last 40 years are now gone, and partly because they've lost their habitat in the forest. Next slide, please. It's more than just the pretty little birds. The deer browse, it degrades the habitat for butterflies as well. Moss, insects, anything that wants to live in that range of the forest cannot live. The butterfly at the right-hand side there at the top relies on the dogwood, or the blueberry, or the viburnum. Those aren't in our forest. The little cute little caterpillar there is sitting on a spice bush leaf. Spice bush are not exactly preferred by deer, but we don't have many spice bush in our forest as a result of the deer browse. Next slide, please. The other angle in our local parks, where you may not be wandering through the forest, you wander through our parks, there on the left-hand side, photo speaks for itself. It's hard to read the sign, but the sign says no dogs allowed. That's interesting. We don't let the dogs in there, but the deer are there. They don't belong there. They defecate there and they spread a variety of illnesses through their feces. Our kids are playing in that park and their risk of contracting Giardia as a result of the deer that are grazing that park. On the right-hand side, there's two photos. One in the middle, these two photos on the right-hand side are from a park behind the skate park on Wilson Boulevard, just shy of Wilson Upton Hill, behind the Powhatan Springs Skate Park. The photo in the middle is of a tree that we planted as part of our restoration efforts in that park. And the deer rub during the rut, when they start looking for the males start looking for females, they rub their antlers and it's destroyed the bark on that tree in the middle. The tree on the right is a tree that's later on in the stage of losing that. I'm not suggesting that we stop installing trees in these parks. It's important that Parks and Recs and other volunteers continue to restore the these parks by planting trees, but the deer are undermining our efforts. Next slide, please. So you are probably wondering what brought us to this point. I saw a question show up in the chat box about what are we going to do. Well, we're going to get to that. Next slide, please. part of driving away the deer from our countryside, we also drove away the mountain lions and the wolves. They've been virtually extirpated from Virginia. Recent press reporting suggests that some states in our area, New York State, for example, is thinking about reintroducing mountain lions to the northern part of the state to help control some of the deer there. There's lots of literature out there about restoring predators, apex predators in ecosystems. Yellowstone, Colorado, lots of books out there that can tell you the experience. It's a very controversial topic, and it's not one I'm anxious to take on in Arlington. I don't think we want wolves wandering up and down Spout Run. Next slide, please. Oh, wait, slow down. One other thing. People will also say, well, what about other things like coyotes and bobcats and bear and foxes? They are not effective predators. Cougars and gray wolves can take down a deer and just kill the deer. It's part of the way they live. Anybody that thinks that coyotes can take down a deer is misguided. Coyotes have shown up with deer in their abdomens when they've been in their digestive systems when they've been captured and killed and picked up as roadkill. But they are usually from scavenging. A coyote is unable to take down anything but a small fawn. Coyotes don't travel in packs. They don't hunt in packs. Foxes don't do the same thing. Foxes prefer small mammals. There's nothing left in our forest that can effectively take care of controlling the deer. Next slide, please. So we need some human intervention. People suggest, what about contraception and sterilization? Boy, that sounds humane. We can take care of the deer by simply tying their tubes or giving the male deer vasectomies. That has not proven to be effective. Department of Game and Inland Fisheries does not approve of those methods for deer management. They approve of them for research, but not for management. There are a couple of problems with it. Deer are prone to something called capture myopathy, which makes it a cruel methodology. Capturing a deer, transporting it, subjecting them to a medical procedure, and then releasing the deer is a stressful action for the deer, and they produce a lot of lactic acid, and it eventually can kill them via heart disease. Some people are still trying it. There's a couple of things that are written up there, PZP and Gonicom. The PZP is delivered by hand, has to be delivered by hand or by dart, needs to be repeated. USDA has actually approved a Gonicom, but it can be delivered by hand or by dart. I'm sorry, that one has to be delivered by hand, the Gonicom. But none of them are effective in open herds. So unless you want to close off Arlington to the rest of the Virginia, it won't work. And deer can swim, by the way, so they can actually swim over here from DC and Rock Creek Parkway. It's expensive, this process is expensive. There's lots of research going on about there. If anybody's interested in them, I'm happy to steer them to some resources about that. But next slide, please. What we're left with is hunting. And this is what's supported by DGIF for managing deer populations. The venison is usually given to homeless shelters or capillary food banks, hunters for the home hunters for the hungry programs. There's three different ways the hunting happens: police sharpshooting, managed hunts with shotguns, and bow hunting with modern archery tackle. The first and the third one, the police sharpshooting and the bow hunting, are the most commonly used in the suburban and urban areas because there's ones that are best in restricted areas. The managed hunting with shotguns really requires a large park that you can shut down. Next slide, please. Fairfax had a terrible accident in 1997. Old Dominion Road, a woman was driving to work, or maybe home from work at the library, and she was killed by hitting a deer. They did a survey of the public. They decided to institute this program. And I'm sorry, I just saw a couple of chat. Do I want to pause for questions? I saw a couple of chat questions. It seems like people are a little upset.
We'll wait till the end, I think.
Okay. Okay.
We're running a little over too, so.
I'll be quick. Fairfax instituted it. They have significant oversight. Katie Edwards, the specialist for the Fairfax County Police, says they've had no accidents, zero, for park patrons or park or pets since the program's inception. So that's over 20 years of records with zero insect. There's a lot of oversight. Next slide, please. Montgomery County has done the same thing about 20 years ago. They began in 1996. They've culled, last year they culled over 1,100 deer out of the parks. They're in 50% of their parks. They also use archery and sharpshooting in urban areas. They've also, in more than 20 years, had zero public safety incidents. They are supported by a private organization that also hunts on property as small as a fifth of an acre. What the private organization does, they bring a portable deer stand. I forgot to say one thing about the archery. That's done from stands, so it's 30 feet up in the air, and they're shooting down into the ground, so the errant arrow goes into the ground. Next slide, please. National Park Service is doing it in Rock Creek Park. They do it with police sharpshooters from USDA. Zero accidents since they've been doing it there. Next slide, please. I'm trying to go as quickly as possible. Prince George's, Prince William County both have programs, police sharpshooting, bow hunting, pilot program in Prince William. Loudoun County does not have a public program. They allow private programs with generous limits in terms of how much they can take, how much hunters can take. Arlington and Alexandria, there is no official program. In fact, Arlington has an ordinance against firing any sort of weapon within 100 yards of a public road or building. Next slide, please. I know I'm running over and I'll try to be quick. Key takeaway I want people to walk away with from here is that what we are doing now, which is nothing, is irresponsible. We are choosing to let the deer win. We are choosing to let the deer take over our forest. They are destroying the habitat for birds, bees, rabbits, insects, moss, everything. There is nothing left there from, like you saw in the pictures, from about head height down, and the deer have taken that away from the rest of the forest population. Doing nothing says we favor deer. We need to, and reinstating some kind of human intervention to get control of the deer is necessary. Next slide, please. And I'll let people read this while you start worrying about getting me some questions. I assume, since I see lots of chat comments, I assume there's lots of questions.
Yeah, so we're gonna use the same mechanism we did before about raised hand sharing, and we have, you know, pretty limited time.
Sure, I understand.
5 minutes, and I'm gonna give the participants an option to speak for 30 seconds of question and then give you maybe 30 seconds to a minute for each one. I only see
sure. two. And I'm also happy, I mean, I was short on time. I'm happy to speak to anybody afterwards. I know this is an upsetting topic.
Okay, the first one is Juliet. Juliet, his name?
Yes, I'm muted.
You're good. I can hear you.
You can hear me, okay, great. Thank you. I was just wondering if you could speak to the issues around Lyme disease, which is become sure. pretty epidemic across the country. And I want to also just share that Lyme disease is implicated in a disorder in children known as pediatric autoimmune neurological syndrome, which is a pretty devastating diagnosis.
It's horrible. And Lyme disease is a horrible problem. There's lots of people doing research. I refer you to someplace called the Carey Institute in New York State. We did not discuss Lyme disease in this topic because there's a couple of studies out there that reducing the deer population does not solve Lyme. When the deer go away, the ticks find someplace else to have babies. Ticks have a 2-year life cycle. They take 3 blood meals. The last blood meal they take is where they propagate their species, and they generally do that on deer. That's why it's called a deer tick. But if the deer aren't around, they do it on they do it on a fox or a rabbit or anything else they can find. They do not propagate on humans, but they find a mammal with fur and they do it there. So the problem with the Lyme disease and the deer connection directly is there's no study showing that it's effective. What is being researched is habitat restorations in the sense that one of the best vectors for Lyme disease is the small white-footed mouse. It turns out that small white-footed mice thrive in a degraded forest that the deer create.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Richard, you have the floor for 30 seconds, please.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, Bill, thank you for the presentation. I don't disagree with what's happening to the forest. I can see it in our backyard. What I'm concerned about is you only listed essentially hunting. Can you not euthanize a deer by using a rifle with a dart of some sort?
Euthanize or sterilize?
Euthanize.
Well, that's what hunting is.
Yeah, I'm talking about a dart, not something that a bolt.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that. I have not seen anybody trying that.
They bring infants and euthanize them, so that's the basis of my question. Or they can anesthetize them. I'm wondering why we can't do that with a deer.
So I have not seen anybody propose that. It's an interesting thing worth studying to see if anybody's done that. So you're suggesting we shoot them with a dart, numb them, put them to sleep, and then euthanize them?
I think he's been muted now, but I guess that's the gist of it.
Okay. So I've not heard that. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I've not heard of that.
Okay.
I don't see why it wouldn't be possible.
The concern I have is that if you shoot a deer with an arrow and the deer isn't killed immediately, you've got a wounded deer running through the woods.
Okay. The wounding rate on the deer, that's a really good question. The wounding rate with archery is a problem historically and not as much currently. The old studies and most of the studies that are out there are based on a bow and arrow that you can think of Robin Hood using in the woods. The modern archery tackle is a very different animal. It is much more mechanized. The wounding rates for the old mod, a bow and arrow, very bad, could be up to 20% wounding rate. The rates that I was rushed at that point, but Fairfax and Fairfax and Montgomery County are reporting in their recent the archery programs less than around 5%, less than 10%, 2 to 9% of their deer are wounded, not killed immediately.
Thank you. All right, we have one more question and then we'll wrap it up. And this is from Kit. Kit, go ahead.
Thank you, Alan. And thank you, Bill. I'm with Arlington Tree Action Group and we share a lot of concerns about the dwindling environment here. But could you just give us a little sense of where our elected leaders are in this? What has been your experience in trying to bring attention to this issue over years? And is there no funding or no interest on that front?
So that's a really good question. And we have briefed the county board. We briefed Libby Garvey. We gave Libby Garvey a longer version of the same presentation before COVID hit. After COVID hit, we gave it to the remaining three county board members at the time. Eric had already taken ill. And they all took the information on board. They had some questions along the lines of what I'm hearing tonight. And they, as far as I know, have directed Parks and Recs to do a deer census with an outside consultant. But really, I think you should ask them directly. I shouldn't be speaking for them. I encourage everybody here to talk to their county board members. Tell them what you think.
That's always a good advice. All right. Well, we are out of time. Thank you, Bill, for coming out. As you can see, there was a lot of spirited discussions, most of it on chat. But
I'm going to take a look at those chats now while you go on. But if I do want to make sure everybody knows how to get a hold of me or us. The last slide didn't have it because I gave you fewer slides because it's a shorter presentation. You can reach us through armin.org.
Okay. Great. And if you can just make sure, I have that email also, Bill, and if anybody on the call would like to connect with Bill and can't, reach out to me and I'll connect you directly.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay. And it's armn.org.
ARMN. And anybody there's several people on the call who know me. My name is Bill Browning, WH@gmail.com.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you. Very much appreciate it.
All right, so we're a little bit behind schedule, but not too bad. And I know Duke, he's a very quick speaker and he doesn't take his time about anything. So Duke, I'm going to unmute you, and I guess the first thing is to put up your presentation, yes?
Yes, you can start with that, and also also unmute John Huntley and Jesse Bowden, who will also be joining. That we're going to have a quasi-panel here.
Okay, give me 1 second here. Share screen.
And while you're doing that, I want to give a shout-out from the chat to Rajan. Whoops. No, I missed it. He's the young gentleman who joined the Civic Federation. He's only 18, but he brought out, I think, a very good point about we're the Civic Federation and we should act decently. And one of the things I remember as president was, you know, trying to, you know, instill the sense of, you know, having respect for different points of view.
Well, you know, on that point, Duke, I'm glad you brought that up. We, the leadership, the board has initiated a process to develop a code of conduct. And we'll be presenting that at the June meeting, a code of conduct that has been a code of conduct that will govern
Jesus Christ.
All participants, all meetings, and all interactions at Civic Federation meetings, as well as on behalf of the Civic Federation. So thank you. And can you repeat again the names of the people that you wanted me to unmute? I'm sorry.
It was John Huntley and Jesse Bowden.
John Huntley
and Jesse. Well, while you're finding, I will start here. This is kind of dovetailing or coming in after the dear folks who were talking about something of the issue of land allocations and what we need in Arlington. So there's kind of an overlay here. But we've done a more of a bottoms up approach here. But I would say that this was a multi-month effort starting in the fall of the committee to prepare a white paper where we evaluated how bond funds have been allocated for parks and rec uses for the last 4 bond cycles, 8 years. It is a Herculean effort that involved over 20 people representing a broad cross-section of Arlington and of CivFed. As chair, I want to commend the broad participation of so many folks. I believe that the number of people involved is one of the largest groups in CivFed's history working on a report of this type, which is the white paper, and the follow-on resolution. The initial draft of the resolution was introduced at our last CivFed meeting and the revised resolution that was approved by a committee vote of 19-1 is the one that we will be voting on this evening. But we've had a couple of interesting developments in the last week that I think need to be addressed before we go into more detail about the, you know, what we did with the white paper and the resolution. And it's the impact of COVID-19 and the county manager's news release concerning the future CIP that he expects to release in June. The county manager informed that it will be a slimmed down version of focusing on COVID-19 plus addressing stormwater concerns, but it'll only be a 1-year CIP. Next year, he anticipates a more comprehensive long-term CIP, which may require bond questions to the voters in 2021. We fully understand this approach and feel it is fiscally responsible. What this means is that it's more than likely that this year's CIP will have limited CIP financing for parks and recreation in the traditional sense. Notwithstanding the predicament of the county faces because of COVID-19, this resolution and the accompanying white paper still has value and should be considered at this time. First, there are 3 recommendations. The first one, of a more balanced CIP, can be used as a guiding principles for formulation of future CIPs, including next year. We hope that this resolution will have a similar impact as our 2016 resolution concerning land acquisitions, whereby the recommendation of 30 acres land acquisition goal for 10 years was incorporated into the public spaces master plan. The second recommendation concerning generational opportunities for land acquisition is valid even within a pandemic. The question of taking advantage of generational opportunities for land is more a question, not of financial resources, but a political will. Keep in mind that the Rouse property, which is mentioned in the in the resolution and white paper is not the only property that is on the generational opportunity list, but over the years, the county has not moved aggressively in acquiring these properties. Keep in mind that in 2015, Community Facility Study made a strong statement on the need for the county to have an aggressive land acquisition policy, not only for parks, but also for schools and future public service needs, such as fire stations, given the anticipated population increases that were forecast for the year 2040. The third recommendation of the resolution and of the white paper concerns dual purpose land acquisition for flood mitigation and open space. This dovetails with the outline of the anticipated CIP to be released in June by the county manager, where he mentions right now that there will be a focus on stormwater management. Overview of findings, especially of Appendix A, which are all the spreadsheets that we have, and interpretation of the aggregate chart reflecting the overall $126 million in park and recreation related funding over four bond cycles. I've asked John Huntley to provide an overview. I met John through my open data involvement with the county, and who played a major role in helping the committee prepare the white paper. Many thanks to John for your contribution. He will be followed later by Jesse Bowden, who will provide a background on the resolution itself with long-term involvement within CIVFED. We need to thank Jesse for her contributions and bringing forth this resolution. With that opening statement of mine, I'll now pass it over to John, who will give you a background of how we developed, the charts and the spreadsheets that are a key part of the white paper.
So Duke, should I change slides or just leave this one up?
Oh, change the slide. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. Now this is the aggregate of looking at all four bond the bond cycles and how we generated the $126 million, which is the total bond funds in the second column to the left there. John, if you want to take it away.
Thank you very much, Duke. I really appreciate being invited into this project. I had a lot of fun working with you and everybody else in the committee. So in this analysis, the Parks and Recreation Committee evaluates long-term investment in Arlington's parks and recreation infrastructure. The 2016 Parks and Recreation Needs Assessment Survey and the Public Spaces Master Plan emphasize the need for investment in open spaces for their health, environmental, and economic benefits. We evaluate the county's investment to determine whether the proportion of funds dedicated to open spaces is adequate to meet the county's current and future needs. For this analysis, we examine the biennial capital improvement plans. The biennial capital improvement plans, unlike the annual operating budget, are how Arlington funds investment in its future parks and recreation resources. By contrast, the annual operating budget, which provides the year-to-year funding for programming and maintenance, does not address long-term parks and recreation needs. We categorize different types of parks and recreation spending in the last four capital improvement plans adopted in 2012, 14, 16, and 18. Although some financing comes from alternate sources, the vast majority of financing for these types of projects comes from the bond issues. We determine how these bond funds were allocated between recreational improvements and investments in open space. To do this, first we created a list including all projects for which the primary mission is to support development of parks or recreation. Projects such as trail modernization, park rehab and construction, recreational facility improvements and construction, and open space land acquisition are all included in our analysis. Projects that are tangentially related to parks and recreation, such as the bike share program or the on-road bike facilities, are not included in the analysis. The capital improvement plan is broken up into numerous sections. Most of the parks and recreation projects are included in the local parks and recreation section. However, there are a few bond finance projects in the public and government facilities section as well. Although the capital improvement plans describe spending projections for the subsequent 10 years, we focus on the first 2 years, which are included in the bond issue. Using projects within that two-year window across multiple capital improvement plans is the best way to accurately catalog investments without double counting or omitting projects. For example, we used the 2016 Capital Improvement Plan to catalog projects for fiscal years 2017 and 2018, and we used the 2018 Capital Improvement Plan to catalog projects started in fiscal year 2019 and 2020. Using that list of projects, we can evaluate how the county is prioritizing its spending and whether those expenditures are consistent with the advertisements of the bond issues, resident sentiment gauged by the survey, and priorities articulated by the Public Spaces Master Plan. Since 2012, the county has authorized a little over $126 million in bonds to finance parks and recreation-related expenses. We separate this $126 million into the five categories you see on the slide: parks, recreation, open space, natural habitat open space, urban open space, and land acquisition. These five categories were chosen because they broadly reflect the options from the questions populating the Parks and Recreation Needs Assessment Survey. Projects are sorted into each category based on their descriptions, bolstered by the expertise of Parks and Recreation Committee members who have been involved in some of these projects. In some cases, the expenditures are split among more than one category. Categorization is admittedly subjective, and reasonable minds could certainly disagree about how to categorize certain parts of projects. Nonetheless, reasonable changes to categorization would not change the broad conclusions reached by the committee. Of the $126 million authorized to finance parks and recreation spending, a little over 85% goes toward recreational uses. A huge amount of this comes from construction, improvement, or expansion of recreation facilities. This includes the 2012 $45 million Long Bridge development issue, the 2014 $4.5 million issue to rehab recreation facilities at Lee, Dawson Terrace, Aurora Hills, and Lubber Run, and a 2016 $7.5 million issue to expand the Barcroft Gymnastics and Lubber Run facilities. Much of the rest of this category of spending covers improvement to and construction of athletic fields, basketball courts, lighting, rest facilities, parking lots, and playgrounds. Only the remaining 15% are used to support open space. Of the remaining 15%, about 7% or $8.7 million is dedicated to park improvements, about $6 million or 4.75% for land acquisition, and about 2% for developing natural habitats in urban open spaces. This low level of investment in open spaces deprives county residents of the environmental, economic, and health benefits of open space, and also limits opportunities to expand recreation facilities in the future as Arlington's population grows. Thank you.
Duke?
Yeah, okay. Thank you. I'll make one comment on the through the chat about the COVID issue. I agree, someone had made a comment about the fact that with COVID, it looks like we need more, you know, natural spaces because of a lot of people are basically discovering, you know, the parks that we have right now. But with that, I think we can go flip it over to Jesse and flip the slide to the next slide, where we have the resolve statements for the resolution. The whereas is of the resolution, not shown here, but which was submitted and shown in the newsletter, are effectively a recap of the executive summary of the white paper. Jesse, if you can please take it away.
Thanks, Duke. As Duke stated at the beginning, we had 6 or 8 weeks of active conversation and iteration on this with much research and debate about down to the letter and the specific wording of what we have here. So this was not a hastily put together resolution, and it reflects evolving ideas and understanding of how the county is allocating funds and purchasing. So the resolve statements are as follows. Be it resolved that the Arlington County Civic Federation recommends the following. One, that the county balance its fiscal year 2021 and 2022 CIP investments to fund passive park features, including wildlife habitat and open space. trails and parkland acquisition on a more equitable basis with respect to its recreational investments so that these investments more closely align to the public's demonstrated needs beyond mandated elements such as rain gardens and other environmental mitigation. Two, that the county should demonstrate more forward-thinking and commitment to land acquisition for passive park use as reflected in the PSMP by purchasing the 9-acre Rouse property at the corner of Wilson Boulevard and North McKinley Road, since it is identified as generational and a unique opportunity site in the strategic plan. And three, that the county should consider as a high priority dual purpose sites that can be used for flood mitigation and open space natural habitat as mentioned in the stormwater master plan. And if you go to the second, to the next page, the next slide. Yeah. And be it further resolved that the accompanying report should be considered a follow-up to this 2016 Civic Federation white paper concerning park land acquisition. The accompanying report also falls under the auspices of the 2016 Civic Federation resolution asking the county board to acquire a minimum of three acres of park land per year on average over the coming decade, which was passed by a vote of 63-1-1 in February of 2016, and the county subsequently adopted this recommendation in its approved PSMP in 2019.
Thank you, Jesse. I want to emphasize what Jesse said there, and going back to my opening remarks, over 20 people worked on this. We had up, I think we ended up having at one time up about 16 various versions of this resolution before we brought it forth. To CIFED itself. So there was a lot of thought and a lot of input that went into this resolution. At this time, Alan, I think we could open it up for questions.
Okay, for questions, please remember to use the raised hand feature in the participants window. If anybody has any questions or comments, I know that there's some things in the chat, but we're going to use the raised hand feature again, and I will unmute folks as they raise their hand. All right, the first one is Juliet Hisney. Go ahead, Juliet.
Not sure if it's a question so much as a statement, which I really wanted to say thank you to the committee for your work on this, and also that I'm support of the resolution.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know there was a couple folks in the chat that had a suggestion. Let's see, who else do we have here? Nicole, go ahead, Nicole.
Hey, I got a little bit of an answer from Carrie, but my initial question was that open space cost on things like grass is obviously cheap, but something like turf or playgrounds is obviously more expensive. Does the spending necessarily correlate with the space dedicated to open space?
Could you repeat that, Nicole? I didn't quite understand it.
So obviously you're spending more money on playgrounds and turf and things of that nature and less on things like grass, which is much cheaper. What is the space dedicated to open, like as a percentage, the space that we dedicate to open space and the space that we dedicate to recreation? As opposed to the spending. That's a crazy discrepancy. I'm just curious about the space as well.
Well, I think the answer to that is a bit complex. I would say having looked and worked with, looked over the Parks Department for the last couple of years, there's a big question is really how much acreage does Arlington have? And that's still an open question because the way that, Department of Parks and Recreation basically categorizes land gets extremely confusing because they're trying to show spaces like what, you know, some of the open space in schools and counting that as part of the public spaces. And so it gets very confusing and it's very difficult to really break out those percentages like you're mentioning.
Yeah.
And I think talking with John, he might want to chime in on this. From the open data perspective, there's some very interesting things about what's happened, like in terms of this open space. As an example, if you look at going one of the footnotes on the resolution, you will notice that we make a comment, and I don't have the resolution in front of me at the moment, but there was a mention that the actual aggregate space is like, you know, less than 1 acre per year. And the calculation that I put in the footnote basically says that we had to subtract, you know, like over 4 acres that at the Taylor Elementary School that the school gave, basically gave to the park. And effectively there, you know, the public spaces master plan puts it out as, you know, that's an increase of 4.7 acres in parkland. Well, in reality, it's, you know, it's land the county already owned, and to the average Joe going by there, he would know that was parkland or school land.
That makes sense.
Nicole, I was just going to add, I've worked a little bit with Duke to begin cataloging open space, but one of the difficulties with answering your question is that I don't know that we have a really detailed accounting of what's there, so it's a little difficult to answer your question. The county does make a lot of good open data available as a quick shout out for open data resources, and we are working with that in order to try to better answer those types of questions.
That's great.
The only, I would just add one other comment, Nicole, and that is that some of the space that we may consider to be open space is actually components of private property. And so that also gets conflated in this conversation, and that property at any point can be removed and for building expansion, etc. So it might be called a park, it might be used as a walkway, and the owner could take everything down and put up a building all the way out to the edges. So it feels a little bit like a moving target in looking at this data.
Okay.
Sorry, we have a question from Jackie.
Actually, it's a, am I unmuted?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, great. It's a comment. I wanted to let everyone know that the Public Services Flood Work Group reviewed this resolution and the white paper and unanimously adopted a statement of support, which was published in the newsletter, and specifically a statement of support for recommendation number 3 for the purchase of dual use property that can be used for flood and stormwater management.
I want to thank Jackie for making that point, and I should have included that in my opening remarks. And Jackie, sorry for not mentioning it.
Thank you. That's not as many as your 20, but it's I believe it was about 10 people. There's some overlap between the two committees, but not substantial.
Okay. All right, the next question is from Mark Blacknow. Go ahead, Mark.
Sorry, I'm trying to come back up to this. So my issue first, can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. So my first, I was less a question, more an objection. I want to point out when it comes up to the taking or the purchase of the property up at the big nice house at Wilson and whatever it is, I would like to change that to say that it should be for school or parks purposes. School or affordable housing purposes. I'm a little concerned that this has sort of been looked at, you know, by the Civic Federation overall as a like a park opportunity. So we have a lot of very basic like needs in this county. And then I feel like a lot of the Civic Federation and other folks in our county, active folks in our county, have been pushing it as a, we just need more parks because, you know, we're old and we like green land. And it's really frustrating to have to sit in here and listen to this all the time, to folks saying that, I just need more green space for my own life. I have a family. I've got a family that's going to grow big. I see all the people around me, and I am so frustrated to hear constantly the Civic Federation pushing for more nice space for themselves to get to go on for a walk, when in fact what we need it for is schools and we need it for housing. So I'm sorry to take a very long time to say that, but that's why I got on this.
Mark, I can understand your concern. I think the major thing is, I think, in that look at it more holistically, is we need a lot of items, not only for schools, but for public services, especially when you're considering the population increase going to 2040 or 2040, like I had mentioned in my opening remarks. In reality, I think back in 2015, we had a conference and we basically said that we're going to be shoehorning the entire city of Harrisburg, Virginia into Arlington by the year 2040. And there's no mention of, you know, the aggregate land requirements, not only for parks, schools, and, you know, but for, you know, public services. Question that I had mentioned in my opening remarks. In terms of this resolution, we tied it primarily because of the public spaces master plan, which is the planning document from the county. So it's not something that we from the Civic Federation or the committee advocated per se. That's a policy document from the county, which is bringing it to their attention. And in terms of the generational land opportunities, if you go into the public spaces master plan, there are several properties other than the Rouse property that we focused on here that are listed there. So it's not something that we've come up with. But I think generally, the county hasn't done the necessary land acquisition, not, as I mentioned, not only for, you know, for parks, but also for schools and, you know, and other public services going out to the year 2040.
Duke, I really appreciate that. And like, so I am often irritated by people come in at the end of a plan and give their own views. And I'm kind of that guy right now. So I appreciate that. I'm so frustrated that constantly when I come to the Civic Federation meetings, it is always, you know, what we can do to preserve parklands and nice, you know, things for the people who've been here for years. I've been here for 20 years.
No.
You've probably been here for 40 years. I don't know. It just feels like so much of what we talk about is about people who are here now and what we want to preserve and less about what we want to do for the people in our future. So I really wish that we could do better on that aspect.
I think we've addressed that in terms of saying in my opening comments and what we've done in the, is basically we're looking towards the future because of the population increases coming to Arlington. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, not really, but thank
I respect for your view.
All right, thanks. Let's get to the next questioner. And sorry, Tina, who's the next one? Do we know? Edith Wilson, you had a question?
I do, can you hear me?
Yes.
I understand, Mark, where you're coming from, but I couldn't disagree more. We have tipped the balance between single family homes and multifamily dwellings in Arlington years ago now. So many people right now during the pandemic, they have no backyards. It's not about the people who have all of those. They are turning out I live in Shirlington. I look out on Shirlington Park and Jenny Dean Park and the dog park. And oh my God, these families, and they have to come to the parks. And we have to understand that our future is larger buildings with more people in them who need green space. And I just wanted to thank, I'm familiar with the development of this line of thinking and this incredible effort that has gone in to articulate why we have to acquire parkland going forward. Or I don't know where these families and these people are gonna go. And it's just so important that we have a balance between the building and development and the population increase in Arlington and green spaces where everyone can be and be happily. And we really need to understand what this pandemic is doing, because it is forcing people to discover their open spaces and their parks and look on maps and take their kids. And I kind of wish some of them would not get in the stream and remember there's poison ivy and black snakes, but they are out there and I don't think they're going to really forget it. So we really, really need to make sure that the county doesn't, you know, whiz past this. I mean, just think about what being outside has been doing for you all individually. For me.
Sorry. Thank you. Duke, we have limited time. How do you want to handle further? We have several more folks who want to speak. How long do we think we should give each one of them?
I think maybe going on for about, you know, two or three more questions.
Okay. The next person up is
And I think folks maybe ought to, you know, keep their comments to maybe about, you know, 30 to 40 seconds.
Okay. I see Keith Fred. Go ahead, Keith.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. And thanks, Duke and everybody working on this. I just want to bring everybody's attention just to make sure you know that you're probably familiar with recently the Trust for Public Land and their park score gave Arlington a rating of number 4 of all places of similar size cities in the U.S. And part of that reason is Arlington touts this as saying that, well, we've done everything we have to do for open space. But if you look at the actual map that the park score has used, and this is gotten from Arlington County, is all the right-of-ways and the medians along George Washington Parkway are included in Arlington's open space. And that's a large percentage of that. So one thing I need for you, it'd probably be advisable to do when you mention open space, is to add the accessible open space. So just because there's like a median in a four-lane highway, it might consider, oh, it's green and it's open, it's not accessible. And that's something that I think that should be clarified, that the county has used in the past to say that we have all the open space that we need, but a lot of that they use, like I said, are medians and highways, which is not accessible to the public. And one thing that people should realize that Arlington County is being the smallest county in the nation, that are, if you include just accessible open space, we're, I think it's the largest, smallest percentage of any county or municipal area in the country that has accessible open space. So that's the actual, if you include, like I said, so I think it might be wise to include that phrase accessible in further statements. Thanks.
Thank you, Fred. And just to elaborate on what Keith mentioned, is the fact that on the George Washington Parkway, a lot of people don't realize it, but when you go on the George Washington Parkway on Roslyn towards National Airport, on leaving Roslyn, you cross Boundary Channel. Why is it called Boundary Channel? You're actually going into the District of Columbia, even though you're on the west side of the Potomac River. Most of the parkway on the west, that between Roslyn to the 395 interchange, is basically actually in the District of Columbia, and it's not part of Arlington legally. Yet a lot of the land descriptions and a lot of the acreage, you know, tries to include that as Arlington open space.
All right, we've got time for
just for clarification.
Thanks, Duke. Steph Pryor, go ahead. Go ahead.
This is Steph. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
So Steph Pryor from Penrose, and I would like to say I am a middle-aged person who's living in a multifamily duplex. So not all people, unlike the chat, as to that comment about the old white people. Sir, please be civil. So my comments about the percentages, more than 65% of the households in Arlington County are multifamily. So in Europe, where a lot of my family lives, we have balconies everywhere. Balconies are not a common thing to have here in this country for some reason, and especially not here in Arlington. And those of us who've been working on form-based code and other things, we have been trying to promote that, but unfortunately the developers are not promoting the little minor green space. So with this, to reiterate what Renee says, I definitely want to support the vote for this. And there are a lot of factors, consideration, and it is a hard trade-off between the green space, however, the long-term health for many reasons, stormwater, along with everything else. So I would strongly encourage for folks to vote for this resolution at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Steph. And then we have one more, and that's Adam Rasmussen. Adam, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I'll try to get this as quick as I can. I have a lot to say. So I was one of the members of the Parks and Rec committee who labored on this. And I first want to say that I wholeheartedly support the effort to increase the amount of resources that we're putting toward land acquisition. And I also want to thank my fellow committee members for being willing to listen to my point of view, even though they tended to be against what most of the members of the committee were agreeing to. But I do have to say in the end that I strongly suggest or hope that you will vote against this resolution. There are five issues quickly, which were mentioned, some of them were mentioned by other people in the questions. But first, the methodology for breaking down the spending was not really followed, and it tends to be try to be precise, but at the same time, it can't be precise. It lumps a lot of spending that was spent on, you know, quote unquote, open space, but was put toward recreation because it happened to be part of a larger project. And I do understand that the county makes it hard to break it down, but I think that too often, the methodology puts things in that category. Second, and I can give examples if you want, defining open space narrowly as unscheduled casual use space, I think is problematic because open space means a lot of different things to different people. And I think that we should focus on trying to figure out how it is that we use the space that we have rather than try to say that we need to only exclusively or permanently do it in one way versus the other. Third, there was a failure to, and Nicole Merlin mentioned this in her question, there's a failure to account for the fact that spending on recreational space is a lot more expensive than it is to be able to leave space open to grass growing and trees. Not to say that that's not important to do that, but it's a lot more expensive to do it for recreation. So that doesn't account for it. I believe, and I'm not 100% sure about this, but I believe about 4 to 5% of the parkland is dedicated to field space, not necessarily recreation space, but just to field space. So it is a very small percentage of our park space is dedicated to fields, which is what primarily the committee was considered to be recreation space. Fourth reason, the reliance again on a single survey to have adequate data for the county residents wanting us to spend less money on recreation and more on natural space. Fifth, I think the resolution puts the City Federation at odds with the many families with kids who benefit from the recreational sports programs that the county spends money on. And I think that those families are underrepresented in the survey, and they're underrepresented in the Civ Federation. And I think that it's going to put us at odds. And once again, it's going to result in just like it was for the Public Spaces Master Plan, that people are going to ignore this, or they're going to see it as, you know, the Civ Federation, you know, doesn't have anybody in there that is interested in what families want. And I'm not saying that's the case, but that's what is going to, I think this resolution is going to send the message once again that that's the case. So finally, I'll end up by just saying that I think this really is about how we use the space, little space that we have. And I would really like it if we'd spend our time thinking of creative solutions on how we can use the space in ways that are both recreational and casual use. And I think there are ways to do it, but demonizing recreational programs and the families that need them is not the way to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. All right, Duke, before you go any further.
I wanted just to make just two quick comments. Number one, as John mentioned in his remarks, you know, reasonable people could come up with slightly different results because of, and if the reason of the footnote that's made on the table that basically that is difficult to break down, you know, some of the expenditures by the categories. So we recognize that, you know, different, if you try this again, the results might be slightly different, but the overall thrust is probably the same. In terms of some of the uses that of the terms that Adam mentioned, we're basically using the same terminology that was used in the Public Spaces Master Plan and what is used generally within, you know, within Parks and Recreation Departments concerning, you know, the use of park lands.
Okay.
I just wanted to add one thing, if I may.
Go ahead.
In response to that, one of the things that I think of policy interest is to try to equate the cost of this the project with the benefit that we're going to get out of it. And so I don't completely understand why something cheaper means we spend less money on it. Usually that would, unless the benefits from open space are very disproportionate from the benefits of recreational use, that the cheapness relative inexpense of open space would actually be an argument to spend more, not less, on the expenditure.
Thank you, John. All right, so we are pretty much out of time for comments. Duke, do you want to call for a vote on this, or how would you like to proceed?
I think we ought to call for a vote, and I recall, because we're looking at a resolution that's already there, I think we, you know, you can basically say we can call for a vote. And okay. Now we can have this, you know, if anybody has any comments that they want to make concerning, you know, the resolution and or should we just move straight to a vote?
A vote.
Second.
Okay, so we have a vote, we have a second. So basically, here's how we're going to proceed, and we're not set up to really do on-the-fly editing of a resolution in this meeting. I wish we were, but the logistics, identifying people and authenticating them, we haven't set it up to require authentication. So, Dennis, you have sent out the Tina, can you unmute Dennis? I'm trying to unmute him. Dennis, can you unmute yourself, maybe?
Okay, I'm ready to go.
Okay, yep.
Okay. The ballots have been sent out to 240 odd people. I mean, it's there, just to open it up and then look for the blue box in the bottom, okay? And that will allow you to vote. You can vote. Can approve the resolution, not approve the resolution, or abstain. And that's the same with the meeting minutes resolution. You can vote for two resolutions, you know, approve them, not approve them, or abstain. But please do it. This is your vote is private here. Nobody knows how you vote. So okay. Take advantage of it.
Go ahead.
I would say, Alan, I liked a lot of what Keith Fred had mentioned. And but because we the limitations of, you know, playing around with the verbiage, some of his thoughts I think could be used in whatever cover letter we sent to the county board.
Yeah, unfortunately we're not set up to really edit a resolution live here, so it's basically going to be an up or down vote or abstain.
Up or down vote, but we can include some. I think Keith Fred made some very good comments there. We can include that in a cover letter to the board if the resolution passes.
Okay. So the email has gone out. Everybody, all the delegates should be getting an email with the voting mechanism, both for the previous approval of the minutes and this one. And if it's not approved, then we will take it back to committee. And if there are comments that anyone has that they would like to have included in the transmittal to the county board, please let Duke know and the committee. All right, so that was spirited. I wish, again, there was a way to handle live resolutions, and we'll work on that as a board. Please bear in mind this is new for all of us, but we should be able to try and do live updates to a resolution. It's just going to require some additional steps to authenticate people and make sure we know in a live vote, who is a delegate and who is not? Because that's ultimately what it comes down to, right? We can't like just let anybody who's on, because this is an open meeting. So we need to limit votes to participants, to delegates or designated alternates. And the only way we could do that is currently is to use the offline email method. There are ways to do it live in a meeting, but it would require people to log in specifically to this meeting with their own unique logins. And we will investigate ways to do that, but for now we're just not set up. So it's gonna be an up or down vote on this resolution. And I apologize for not making it.
Vote is open until midnight on this.
Yes,
on
the, oh, yes. And the votes are open until midnight. Okay.
Hello? I didn't get any email.
Are you
a delegate or not?
I'm an alternate delegate. In fact, I've been president of this organization for 40 years ago.
Well, and who is this? Bert?
I haven't gotten one either. This is Bernie Byrne.
Yes.
Okay, well,
I got one. This is Ron Haddock.
What are you burning? Seriously, guys.
Just refresh your email.
So you don't want us to use the little icon here that says yes or no?
No. It's going to email. That was only an experiment.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. I got an email, and I replied to it already.
Yeah, I got an email. It doesn't say vote. It talks about a resolution, but check your email.
But it's a long – you have to go all the way to the bottom of the email to get where you would need to say yes or no.
There's a blue box at the bottom of the email.
Yeah, exactly.
When did this right, go
out? So, just right now. Spam folder. Like check your spam folder.
Right about a minute ago.
I still don't have my email, Bernie Byrne.
Check your spam folder.
I what? Spam? Okay.
It's not in spam.
Okay, so well, Renee, let me check.
It's not in spam.
I did it.
Bernie, you have more than one email address?
Yeah, Bernie's 102.
No, it's just one, bhburn at bhburne at yahoo.com.
Huh.
Can I just suggest? This is Juliet Jose. Can I just suggest that perhaps if people don't receive the email, that they alert the leadership to that fact?
Thank you. I was just about to say that. Thank you, Juliet. So anybody who did not get an email that is expecting one, please send us an email immediately to the board. You can send it to me and I'll forward it to the right people and we'll make sure that you get it. And given that, we'll leave voting open. Dennis, let's leave it open until noon tomorrow. Okay.
Not a problem.
All right.
So anybody who didn't get it, I'll try to send it to you again. But remember, this only goes to delegates.
This is Janice Hall. I didn't get it either.
Okay, please send an email to the leader.
Which email address do we send it to?
Okay. All right. I'm going to mute everybody's line. Okay. Everybody's muted. All right. So that concludes the vote and the complications about the vote. As I said, we were working on ways to have a live update to a resolution, and it sounds like that resolution was one that would have benefited from that. For now, the committee worked on it very extensively, and there's a very long, well-documented white paper. It was approved by the committee as well as the Public Services Committee, so anybody has the option to approve or not of the resolution as written. And I understand that in the past we did offer on the floor amendments. We couldn't do that today, but we were working on a way to do that. Okay, so old business. There's one item on the agenda, and that's the nominating committee. We are still looking for folks to assist in terms of nominating leadership for next year. We're gonna have a slate of candidates and a vote and maybe some discussion at the June meeting. If you are interested in serving on the nominating committee, please reach out to Duke Banks. And then in terms of new business, I've been asked to read a statement on behalf of the Environmental Affairs Committee. And I will read that quickly. And while I'm reading that, if anybody has any new business, please raise your hand and I will unmute you to try and address it. The Environmental Affairs Committee is seeking delegates and alternates who would like to work on environmental topics of special interest to their constituents. This committee can cover a broad range of issues from air and water quality, natural and wildlife resources, land use, trees, and others brought to attention by Civic Federation delegates. The committee will also be in communication with the Cognizant County Advisory Commissions throughout the year. You may be interested in some projects targeted for investigation and reporting to the Civic Federation this year. First, informal workshops to find tree-friendly actions and regulatory options that can be developed through consensus. This scoping exercise will explore opportunities to protect and enhance the tree canopy with citizens, public officials, special interest groups, and developers, and report back to delegates. Second, active tracking and participation in the revision of Arlington's Urban Forest Master Plan and Natural Resources Master Plan, which will be combined into an integrated Natural Resources Master Plan over the next 12 to 18 months. The planning is at an early stage, allowing good opportunities for meaningful input. Third, monitoring the current operating and capital improvement programs with an eye toward reporting back to the Civic Federation on key environmental concerns. Please contact Mary Glass if you're interested in pursuing these topics or have others you would like to suggest to the committee. Please send me, this is Alan, an email if you need Mary's information. Okay, and I'm gonna check to see right now if there's any additional new business. And I mean new business. One moment here. Where are my participants list? Okay, so Jesse, did you have something that's new business, Jesse? Nope. Okay. Nicole, did you have new business, Nicole?
Asking if with this resolution you would be commenting on things like the Met Park program, or if this would just be a standing resolution as a general aspiration.
I'm going to defer that one to Duke. Duke, you want to comment on that at all?
Can you repeat the question again, Nicole?
There's a Met Park in Crystal City is going to be a large public space, and they're taking public comment right now about how that space should be used. And I'm curious if we might want to actively use this resolution as an impetus to comment on that development, or if this will generally just be used as like a statement resolution.
I think it's more of a statement tied in to the overall formulation of a CIP. Okay. Keep in mind that when we started this back in November, our focus was that, the CIP was supposed to come out in, approximately May, June this year. Obviously, COVID-19 threw a monkey wrench into that, and so we're responding to that. We were not contemplating using it at all in terms of the Met Park development that's going on in Crystal City. But but having said that, I encourage people to make their comments known about Met Park.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And we're going to try to restrict this part to new business. Thank you, Nicole. And I'm sorry we didn't get to you earlier. Renee Greenwell, did you have some new business to discuss? And I'm trying to, okay, you're unmuted.
I'm okay. Move on. Just make it end.
All right. Thank you. And Dennis, you had something?
No, I was just saying, I'm going through the list of people. So they didn't receive the email, the constant contact said it was sent. And see, like Bernie, you opened it.
So, okay, let's get the, okay. We'll worry about that offline, but thank you.
Okay, good enough.
All right. Margie Bell, did you have new business to deal with?
No, I'd raised my hand before just to say I didn't get the email to vote.
Okay, Dennis will look into that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Edith Wilson, did you have anything specific about
new I'll business? I'll pass.
Okay, thank you. Joe Pelton, I believe you already raised your concern. Yes?
I don't know. Can you unmute me?
Yeah, you're unmuted. We can hear you.
I don't know to whom I send the fact that I don't have a ballot, and I think there are a number of other people don't know to whom. I'm going to send something to Duke Banks, but who else do I send to indicate I never got a ballot?
Dennis, is it secretary@civfed.org? Is that correct?
Then give it a try, okay? Or membership@civfed.org is another way of doing it.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody. And I believe that is it. So does anybody out there, Duke or Tina, I'm going to unmute everybody here. I'm going to cross my fingers. We need somebody to call to adjourn.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
All right. We are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you for doing the meeting this way. It was great.
Thank you, everybody.
Not perfect, stop but... even when we're not quarantined and leave the chat on so you don't get so much other stuff. Bye.
All right. Bye. Thank you,
I enjoy the chat.
Thank you.
Good job.
Did we adjourn?
We're adjourned, yes.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
John Meistat, how are you?
Hey, good. I'm here. Can you hear me?